is PRN.FM. The show is Insight. It's Thursday, a gorgeous Thursday in New York City. Liz Malone, my name's Mark Farrell. Hey, Liz, how are you feeling today?
I'm doing okay, Mark.
You look extraordinary.
Thank you.
Happy and red and vibrant and very spring-like. You look like you just popped out of a J. Crew magazine.
Right off the pages, right?
Oh, yeah. You know, doesn't it just like blow your mind when you see all these magazines? They do work because you're like, oh, yeah, that outfit looked great on my wife. Or maybe you say that about your boyfriend. Yeah, I'll get him those nice cargo pants. And it works. Advertising really works. We were just talking a few minutes ago about some advertising. We're like, what color is that truck? I don't know the name of the company, but I know the color of their truck. You know, you see everything on, especially New York City, you're just inundated with just signs and logos and slogans everywhere you go.
Well, it pays to invest in really good branding.
It certainly does.
Yeah.
So Thursday's here, a.k.a. Thirsty Thursday, and it kind of, you know, gave me some hopeful news today because, you know, you can't be on the air forever in New York City because it's kind of like a dog. You have to take you out in the pasture and, you know, you have to be taken out. But I have my second career choice plan.
Okay.
Well, there's a woman in England who's nearing 100 years old, and she's been bartending since 1940. That's the route I'm going.
I have a feeling she makes a real good stiff drink.
She probably does. Yeah. She's probably going to end up being a stiff drink behind the bar. Stiff corpse. I mean, I think she downed it from 7 days a week, down to 4 days a week. So she's kind of taking it easier on herself. But she estimated she's poured over 2 million drinks, and that's probably to my ancestors, the Farrell family alone, who came over from Ireland to see her in England.
Wow.
It was 2 million people.
Hey, well, cheers to her.
What about the Malones? The Malones were probably in there.
Somewhere there, I would imagine.
So I'm really happy that I have my next career choice lined up because, you know, you're never going to retire. Are you going to retire when you get to 60s or so unless you win six numbers in Lotto?
Well, I have a grandfather who worked up until he was 90.
Good for him.
Yeah.
And then what did he do?
Then
traveled?
He
golf? Bridge?
He chilled. He took a little time.
Lazy boy?
He worked for the Yankees up until 90
years
old.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yankees and the Mets.
Excellent.
Mm-hmm.
What type of capacity?
He was a founding member of the ticket seller union.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well-connected man.
It's not a bad connection to have. My uncle is still with the union. He was there from the early age of 18. And so now he's the senior guy on the list.
Oh, fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Good stuff. You got good roots.
I'll take it.
So, you know, I guess along the same guidelines of pouring it on, I should say, Lance Armstrong. Liz, I don't know if you know this about me. I was a major Lance Armstrong fan for a long time. I was a road cyclist for years, never getting my driver's license until I was 25 due to my visual impairment. I'd always been on my bicycle, so therefore I always got into road cycling, did a lot of races, a lot of triathlons. And when Lance came on the scene, I was... Sign me up, man.
Mm-hmm.
Seven tours, about the fifth tour, I'm still into him. Seventh tour win, I was very and highly suspicious of Lance. So we all know this is water under the bridge, but his sponsors are suing him for a lot of the sponsorship money that he received. And this is actually a small amount of money that I think he's getting sued for, $2 million. So in the scheme of things, of all the money he accumulated over the years, that's kind of a pocket change. But nonetheless, he had stated vehemently, I will never be a rat, meaning that he will never blow the whistle on his teammates. He always put his teammates under the umbrella of, yes, they doped with me. They were on the bus. They were in the hotel rooms. They were all part of this major plan that I kind of executed. But he said, I will never be a rat. Well, we know his word is as good as the day is long, right? Not that good. So, of course, he ratted out his teammates recently.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And you know, it's no big surprise, but it still kind of goes along the lines of, this guy, you don't even know what to believe nowadays. You really don't know what to believe. And when he was on Oprah, you know, he made a statement. Oprah asked him, actually, do you believe you cheated? And Lance responded, well, you know, I looked up the word cheat before I came on your show. And I was like, really? You really looked up the word cheat? Did you see your picture next to the word cheat? And he said, no, I do not believe I cheated on any of those tours. And there's a lot of backstory to that, but that was the short of it. So recently in this lawsuit, the sponsors are trying to get their money back, rightfully so. There's 10 questions he actually had to answer, legal questions, I guess under oath. They were actually handwritten questions. And one of the questions is, do you think you cheated? And what did he say, Liz? He swung the other way.
So now he does
Now
think,
he does think he
okay,
cheated.
So he doesn't believe he cheated, but he thinks he cheated?
I don't know the semantics right there, but he did proclaim, yes, he did cheat.
Okay.
So we can all rest assured, don't believe a word this guy ever says again.
Whichever way the wind blows.
Absolutely, absolutely. So that's kind of a segue into our topic today. His is pretty much a wrongful confession, depending on the day, but along much more of a serious topic are overcoming adversity. And overcoming adversity encapsulates a lot of things in this world and for each and every one of us. For myself, being visually impaired and having an alcohol dependency and losing a brother to suicide, father having Alzheimer's, and the list goes on and on. And Liz has certainly some history and adversity as well, and so do you. Whether it's apparent or not, maybe you don't even know it or realize it or even want to accept it. But there's been a situation you've read in the papers that people have been, and this has been happening for years, wrongly accused and imprisoned for crimes they did not commit. So when I read about Derek Hamilton, who spent 21 years in jail for a crime he did not commit and was released back in 2011, again, for 21 years for a crime he did not commit, it made me think about, wow, we need to get this gentleman on our show because it's imperative to find out and uncover, number one, the focus of today's show is going to be more of how he coped for those 21 years in prison, the adversity of all the components of being behind bars. More importantly, about what's wrong with this legal system. How broke is it? So joining me today is Derek Hamilton. He's actually a local guy. Derek was recently on the steps of City Hall, and we're going to find out what he was happy to proclaim. And Derek, welcome to Insight.
Good morning. Good morning. How you doing?
I'm very glad to have you on the show, my friend. And you sound like a man with a mission.
Absolutely. I mean, after you have been through what I've been through and you have your liberty, you enjoy it. But more than all, you don't forget the people that you left behind that, you know, in your same situation. So, I mean, I'm here trying to not only, you know, right the wrong that was done to me, but help others that doesn't have a voice.
Now, how did it feel? How liberating did it make you feel when you were on the steps of City Hall with our next guest, well, we'll meet in a second, with Lonnie, to proclaim that, you know, there was so much wrong done to you and other individuals on the steps of City Hall? You proclaimed Detective Scarsella, one of the leading detectives on your case, who doctored some evidence and testimony, that, you know, change is in the wind, and I will be justifiably exonerated soon.
Absolutely. Well, it made me feel good because prior to me getting here, I had guys like Lonnie Sari doing it for me. So to join him, you know, on the steps of City Hall when he'd been there with my family and friends previously was a great feeling. It was something that really made me feel liberating and something that I really, really enjoyed doing.
Lonnie Sari is president of FalseConfessions.org, an advocacy group, and he's also the owner of the firm Sari Communications, dedicated to exonerating the wrongfully accused. Welcome to the show, Lonnie.
Hey, thanks for having us on. We really appreciate it and the opportunity to discuss what happens. I think you used the word that Lance Armstrong cheated. You know, I never thought about it that way, and in terms of a wrongful conviction that the police or the prosecutors cheat. I guess that was too soft a word. As I like to say, wrongful convictions don't just happen by mistake. There's usually somebody or some entity that either hides evidence or you know, pushes for a conviction or obtains a false confession. But I guess cheating may be the right word.
Absolutely. Now, you've been involved with a lot of high-profile cases. Marty Tancliffe, Long Island case, the West Memphis 3.
Right.
What got you involved into this world of imprisonment?
Well, you know, I was always, you know, always dealt as a progressive person, although, you know, and tried to bring that to my work, whether I was representing General Motors or on race issues and tried to, you know, get them to change where they needed to change. But dealt with high-profile legal cases in my work, and on civil cases represented the estate of J.R. Tolkien and the estate of Bob Marley and some of their battles to maintain their royalties. But one day it's got to be about 12 years ago, I got a call from a private detective named Jay Salpeter, who is a boyhood friend of mine. As I like to say, he went to the police academy and I went to the anti-war movement. Then it was, to date myself, the Vietnam anti-war movement. And years and years later, he called me up and he said, I'm working on this case of this young kid who's not so young anymore in Long Island, and he falsely confessed. And I said, yeah, why would anybody confess to a crime they didn't do? He said, no, you got to read the papers. And I read the work and began working on behalf of Marty Tankleff, who was sentenced to 50 to life for the murder of his parents. And we discovered how he was coerced into confessing, and it became apparent that there were many, many cases like this. In fact, in New York State alone, 50% of all the cases that have been exonerated involved a false confession. So that's what started me on it, and I sort of worked on that case for years and then was contacted by Laurie Davis, Damien Echols' wife in Arkansas, to please bring what she thought was my expertise to that case. And I was part of the defense team, and we were able to free Damien Echols off of death row and Jason Baldwin and Jesse Miskelly out of a life without parole. And then Derek contacted me from prison. But I told when Derek contacted me, I said, I can't do it anymore. I'm too busy. And Derek is a leader, and by force of will, he said, you know, one way or another, I'm getting you to help me. So.
Quite the endeavor that you've taken on, and you've certainly exonerated many, many people, and you should be very proud about that. Derek, how did you actually hear about Lonnie in prison?
I was reading something called Justician Magazine that comes out of Rochester, and it indicated that Lonnie had worked on the Marty Tankleff case, and more appealing, he did it pro bono. So I said, hey, let me write this guy and see if I can.
Hey, I can afford that, right?
Right. So basically, I was at the point in my case where I needed the public to know about the great injustice that was being done to me. I made motion after motion, and it was being denied, not because of the evidence, because judges just felt like they can deny it, that, you know, district attorney's office and the police were their friends, and I needed somebody to just let the public know about the ordeal that I was going through. And I thought that Lonnie had the expertise and was the best person for me.
Now, Ken Thompson is the new Brooklyn DA, as many of you know, who are international listeners would not know that, one of the boroughs of New York City, Manhattan, I should say, of New York. He has dedicated himself and created a task force to investigate these cases. And Lonnie, how confident are you in this matter?
Well, you know, we're pleased that Ken Thompson was elected. He certainly ran on part of his platform was to look at these Scarcella cases and hopefully others. People like Derek Hamilton and other guys in Brooklyn who were wrongfully convicted worked for him. Yet at the same time, he has a lot on his plate. And on his plate is not only these cases, but as I like to say, and then they've asked for patience, but I would say these guys have waited patiently for decades. So we need Thompson to really develop what's called a conviction integrity unit that's transparent, that is collaborative. Most of these conviction review units are really prosecutor, you know, conviction maintenance units. And what they try to do is they do what the prosecutors have done for years, is discount new evidence. But we're asking Thompson to really take a fresh look. He's committed to do it, but he needs to move quickly.
And these are about 50 cases so far?
At least. And, you know, that's a tall order, but again, Derek spent 21 years. His colleagues, Kevin Smith, 27 years, Sunday Moses, these were the three guys who were at a press conference, 18 years, all Scarcella-related cases, all cases, as Derek says, have had evidence that Scarcella and others, you know, fabricated against them for decades. So everybody's known this, but it took, you know, it's taken a long time for it to come to light. But, you know, we're asking Thompson and other prosecutors in New York. Prosecutors essentially are held harmless for their actions. So they can lie and cheat and hide evidence, and nothing really happens to them. We need to make them accountable.
Now, why are they not accountable?
Because they have something called absolute immunity. And the Supreme Court has upheld this, that judges and prosecutors are immune from prosecution in the course of their jobs. So if they're prosecuting, obviously, if in fact they move off of their job and go into investigation or administrative issues, if they consciously hide evidence, they could be brought up on certain charges, but it's very difficult. Very difficult, and it's almost never done because prosecutors are very powerful and judges are intimidated by, you know, they're elected officials. As you know, many prosecutors go on to become Congress and senators and even presidents.
Well,
so it's a very powerful position. They're omnipotent. And, you know, it really takes judges to step in and step up. The judge in Derek's case knew that the prosecutor and the police had acted nefariously.
I think. How do you know this?
I think so. Derek would concur. In fact, he knew it because he wouldn't sentence Derek for a year. Derek was convicted of murder but not sentenced.
That's highly unusual.
Right, Derek?
Yeah, and he made statements that he would give me a new trial. He made statements that he told the prosecutor he can throw this whole case out right now.
On the record?
Put it back together. So, I mean, the evidence was there. It's just the courage. He didn't have the courage to do the right thing.
He made these statements on the record?
Yeah, on the record. They're available to anybody that want to see them. I'll definitely make them. They're public, actually, on a website. So, I mean, they're available.
So do you think he made his inquiries and basically there was a lot of political backlash if he tried to reverse his case?
Yeah, well, what it was is he was intimidated. The prosecutor brought big wigs and Michael Vecchione and other people to court. They sat in the front seat during the hearing, and the judge's whole attitude changed.
And that's when Haynes was in office, right?
Yes, Haynes was in office.
Haynes, I'm sorry.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, it's really interesting because they're all part of the same political club. You know, 50% of all judges across the country are elected. In New York, all the judges are elected, and prosecutors are elected. And, you know, whatever the machine happens to be in power, it's a Democratic machine in Brooklyn,
right.
Then the prosecutors and the judges, you know, go to the same party. You know, it's very hard for them to be, you know what, they could be courageous. It just takes them to stand up. And it takes one judge, and there have been, you know, I can't say that there aren't judges that they're beginning to overturn convictions more. The appellate court and the Court of Appeals is doing more, but they're not doing enough. They really need to make a stand and really hold prosecutors and police to the fire. As I said about Scarcella, he is really just a symptom of a deadly disease, and that disease was allowed to be pervasive in D.A. Hines' office, and the judges allowed tainted evidence to go before jury after jury after jury, and unfortunately, Derek was one of the victims.
And what I would like to say is that, you know, what happened to me, Kevin, and the rest of us already happened. What we're trying to do is stop it from happening to the next 17-year-old kid or 18-year-old, 24-year-old that goes into precinct today. And that's why we're calling for all, for once a suspect get into the police car, should be videotaped from that point on throughout his custodial interrogation, that there shouldn't be a question in this late day whether a guy confessed or not. We have modern technology where we can easily, you know, find out who's telling the truth.
Absolutely. Everything should be documented.
You know, so we need that to happen, and we need double-blind lineups to happen where the police officer doesn't know who the person in the lineup, so they can't suggest to the victim, pick out number two or pick out number three, which often happens. And sometimes you can suggest by just little things, subliminal things. So we need to put double-blind lineups in effect, and we need to make sure that, you know, every arrest is done fair, that the prosecutors just don't take what the police officers give them and speed it through. That's what investigators are there for. Try to find out what really happened and make sure that, you know, the process is orderly.
Go ahead, continue, Lonnie.
Well, I was going to say, we have a new police commissioner in New York, Bill Bratton. We have a new deputy commissioner for training and Ben Tucker. These guys are very good, hardworking, honest, compassionate men. They know the issues. I'm confident that they will do the right thing. It hasn't done yet. We still have not enacted those guidelines, which also all exist in both Connecticut and New Jersey. But we're asking them, and we're asking the police, deputy police commissioner for training, to begin training cadets as they go through the academy to be aware of wrongful convictions and aware of what goes on and how these things can happen, so they're more educated and they're more sophisticated.
Is there any idea, or Lonnie and or Derek, any ideas or concepts or notions, possibly, I hate to use the word amnesty, but for maybe like Detective Scarcella is retired, moved on to a different career. I believe he's in education right now. But regardless of where they are now, maybe they're still on the force, for some way for them to come forward to say, maybe if they're a whistleblower, or they actually fabricated or coerced a witness themselves, for them to come forward without as much punishment as possible, as there would be if it was.
And it's kind of an interesting concept, but it's most of these prosecutors, you know, if you even cases like Marty Tankleff, who's been exonerated, or the Central Park Five, the prosecutor, if you interview them, they will say that Marty's guilty. The prosecutor in the Central Park Five case, a colleague of mine just ran into her recently, she says they're guilty. So even with all this publicity, all this evidence, they still hold on to their convictions. I don't know whether it is just completely tone deaf or, you know, it's very hard for these people to change and very hard for them to move off. You know, you don't get ahead in the society by freeing the innocent. So I am not optimistic that people will not do the right thing unless there's some consequences, and consequences for prosecutors who hide evidence or lie or police. You know, listen, we're not talking about everybody. We're talking about, I mean, minority of people, but that minority affects a lot of people. The estimates are that, let's say, 5% of those people in prison are wrongfully convicted. Well, you know, there's 2.5 million people in prison as we speak. So 5% would be 125,000. That's 125,000 people, 125,000 families, and 125,000 right, you know, criminals who haven't been brought to justice.
Absolutely.
And in this area, the 50% that are wrongly in prison, those are due to false confessions, coercion, et cetera?
And misidentification of witnesses. That's a big thing. Witnesses
huge
are,
number.
Like Derek said about double-blind police lineups. You know, people are shown pictures, people are put in lineups, and there's a lot of coercion, a lot of what they call confirmation bias that goes on where the wrong people are picked out and whether the police have given them a hint or whether it's just part of, you know, having a system that doesn't prevent it by both suspect, both a witness and police officer being unaware of who the suspect is.
Derek, you must have laid in your bunk for thousands of hours, seething, burning mad, knowing that the prime witness recanted her statement and it meant nothing.
Absolutely. I mean, more than anything, you ask yourself, like, I'll give you an example. She testified that they came down to her house in North Carolina, arrested her at the time of trial, and forced her to come in, even though she told them she didn't do anything. And they denied it. I mean, the prosecutor was able to take the stand and Gutman and say, hey, that never happened. You know, I'm laying in my cell, and I had to write North Carolina to get the truth. And North Carolina says, yes, we arrested her. New York asked us to. So it's things like that that make you just, you know, more so continue to fight and understand that if you don't, you know, reach out and try to help yourself, that you'll sit there forever. The burning force that made me survive was that I was innocent. And I knew that I just couldn't sit there and, you know, play basketball or lift weights or do the things that guilty people did, that I had to, you know, stand steadfast on my innocence and fight like an innocent man should. So for me, you know, my innocence was my livelihood. You know, it kept me going every day, every single day. You know, I was in the law library. I was reading something, educating myself, trying to figure a way to get somebody to follow the law. It wasn't that I had any doubt about my evidence because I knew I was in Connecticut at the time the murder happened in Brooklyn. It was just trying to find somebody that would listen. And, you know, I went to, you know, judge after judge, wrote letter after letter. I mean, my most stressful days, I would write the judge because I felt that he was responsible for me being there. And that's how I stay sane. You know,
the original judge, Derek?
Yes, Edward Rappaport was the trial judge, and he was also the judge at several post-conviction hearings.
Right.
And, you know, I would write him. I would write him, you know, a lot of times, like I would write, you know, just anybody and say, hey, you know, why did you do this? What's going on? You know the truth, you know? And those were the things that kept me going, you know?
Good for you. That fueled you.
Uh-huh.
So 1991, Derek, you were age 25. What were your life aspirations before you were imprisoned?
Well, at that time, you know, I was going to school. I was looking to go to school, but I had a unisex salon in New Haven, Connecticut, so I was aspiring to be an entrepreneur. And, you know, I was always a guy good in school and, you know, good with math and things of that nature. But basically, I was trying to become an entrepreneur. So we opened up a unisex salon, and I was in there doing cutting a little hair sometime and, you know, learning the craft.
That's actually where you were arrested by Detective Scarsella, correct?
Absolutely. And I was also a mechanic helper, so I had, you know, a little experience doing fixing cars since I was a younger kid.
Industrious
so,
man.
Yeah, so, you know, I was a mechanic helper at the B&M Garage on 161 Clifton Place in Brooklyn with Benny. So, you know, I was finding myself. I was trying to find what my passion were at that time, you know.
So now we've all seen the movies, read the books, and it's so very true. No one knows this more than you, but everyone in prison is innocent.
You know, that's the problem. See, that is the biggest problem when you say you're innocent. You know, and sometimes it can be the biggest thing to piss you off because that's what you get back. Well, everybody says they're innocent, but everybody doesn't have this evidence. And that would be my response. If you just took time out to read. And in fact, when I went to the parole board for 2 years, I went to maybe about five or six parole boards. And what I would say to them is exactly that. And one time, actually, parole board said, okay, we'll take your word. I said, no, please don't take my word. Look at the evidence. Because my word may not mean nothing to you when the evidence may. You know, and that is the key. You have to have people look at the facts. And what I always said to parole board and what got me out, I said, if you just read the evidence, you would have to come to one conclusion. And when they read the evidence, they released me. But it took five parole boards and a fight to just get them to do that. Because their position was like everybody else. Well, you got a certificate of disposition here that says you're guilty. We can't go against that. We don't want to retry your case. You know, so nobody want to do the work, but everybody want to have an opinion because a court says this guy's guilty or a jury said this guy's guilty. So the stigma of a wrongful conviction does more to you than, you know, it just hurts you all the way around the board. Yesterday I got a call, I'll give you an example, from a parole officer in Connecticut that says, hey, you didn't give us DNA. If you don't give me your DNA soon, I got to violate you. Just yesterday. You know, I gave New York DNA, when, you know, because I'm a New York, you know, convicted prisoner, or, you know, person right now. So I give them DNA. Connecticut wants it as well. So I'm going to go give it to them for the sakes of my liberty. But these are the things that you go through, the threat of always going back to prison based on a stigma of a false conviction. So you never get over that. You know, you never get over that because some guilty people say, I'm innocent. You know, and that's the problem. But a guilty person can never present the evidence that an innocent man can.
Now, we all understand. We have a little understanding, of, certainly, of the challenges and the adverse conditions one faces in a jail, especially when you're in for maximum security for murder. So, obviously, you're not with the friendliest, most affable bunch of people of society.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, you sound like an upstanding citizen, you know, having a business, being industrious, et cetera. And here you are in a box of metal with some scary individuals. Now, how did you cope? I know you said you obviously spent a lot of time in the library and researching and letter writing, and that's very honorable and noble, but there had been times where obviously you hit rock bottom. Yeah, maybe you got depressed.
There was a whole lot of times that I hit rock bottom. Depression, until I learned that I was actually depressed, you know, was the biggest thing for me. I mean, depression comes from the day that you walk inside a prison and, you know, some guard tell you they have to look into, you know, direct them to see if you're hiding contraband. I mean, here's a man, you know, you come from the street with a little bit of respect and dignity, you lose that the moment that you walk inside a prison. So you have to, it's a psychic thing. And then you come around, you know, you used to social stimuli, now you don't have social stimuli. You know, the guy next to you may be talking about committing the next crime, the guy in the next one may be calling some woman a derogatory name or saying something that's so far-fetched from where you are. You know, so you have to just find a center of peace. For me, prayer was, you know, one of the things that kept me going, knowing that I had a strong family, and good morning, and just, you know, believing in my faith kept me going.
Tell me about your worst day and possibly your best day. Obviously, your best day in prison is when you got the parole board verdict, but what about possibly your worst day?
When the jury said guilty. I mean, when the jury said guilty, that was the most painful experience ever. I mean, I just didn't believe it. It was like all the breath was knocked out of me. That was the most painful day ever.
And talk about how time passes. I mean, they say, you know, time stands still in prison. What are your remarks with that?
Every day is the same. I'll be done in a minute. Every day is the same. Every day is the same for you. I mean, you wake up and you want to go home. I mean, that's just the bottom line. Nothing in prison moves you the way that, you know, things in society does. So, I mean, I'll give you an example. If I see my wife on a visit, I'm happy. But when I leave and walk through that back door again, there we go again with the guard. You know, saying, you got to drop him. You got to show me everything. So it brings you back to the most dreadful, painful experience, no matter, you know, how you try to escape it. You know, you're going to escape it for a little while. You're going to come back to the reality of that cell with that toilet, with that that cot right there.
Lack of privacy.
You know what I mean?
Completely demoralizing.
Yes, very demoralizing. And, you know, for any young kids that may be listening or their parents, I mean, one of the things I can say is that, I mean, if you can take them to the Scared Straight program and walk them to a prison just to be able to see it, I think it will touch them, you know, in a different way. And I just want them to know that, you know, you may think you're a little, you know, whatever you're doing is slick. You know, I was young. I thought I was a slick guy. I mean, you can open doors to cops like Scott Sullivan and say, hey, you know what? Here's a guy I can lock up and blend his crime on nobody would care about. So, you know, you have to walk a straight line. You have to not, you know, open any doors where somebody can think that you don't count.
Mm-hmm. We all have points in our life, and I imagine possibly I could even speak for you, Lonnie, and perhaps for Liz, where we're faced with a condition, maybe a loss of a loved one, where we just kind of feel like, you know, we're swimming upstream, and there's no hope, and there's lack of opportunity, or you just feel like the world is against you. Tell me what brought you back to set you straight on the path to say, you know what, I'm innocent. I know this, and obviously you have ebbs and flows of energy and drive and initiative, especially in the environment that where you were. It's very, very hard to be an optimist. How did you bring yourself back on track?
Well, reading. I mean, what for me was reading what other people didn't read. I mean, I had to get self-help books a lot when I was in there. My family was good enough to send them to me. So, you know, education was the most important thing for me to stay focused. I mean, if I didn't have books, if I didn't have, you know, some time to stimuli, I don't know what would have happened to me. I mean, and more than everything, family. I mean, family was the most important thing. My children, when I left, were 6 years old. And watching them grow and, you know, watching them mature challenged me that I had to be better, you know. And that was the most, you know, grounding thing for me. I didn't want this to happen to any of my children. And that kept me going.
That's the voice of Derek Hamilton, and Lonnie Suries are also our guests on PRN.FM. We'll have more with them right after this. Welcome back to PRN.FM. The show is Insight, Liz Malone and Mark Farrell with you on a beautiful, sunny, beautiful Thursday in New York City, coming to you live. My guest today is Derek Hamilton. Derek spent 21 years of his life in jail for a crime he did not commit. Lonnie Suries is president of FalseConfessions.org, an advocacy organization. He also has a firm, Suries Communications, dedicated to exonerating the wrongful accused. I'm sure it's safe to say that you guys are pretty tight.
We have been. Well, you know, Derek didn't tell you the whole story about how he contacted me. So he sends me a letter and says, I want you to work for me. I had just worked about 7 years on Marty Tankov's case pro bono. And I said, I just can't work. I can't work for free anymore. And, you know, I thought that would be enough to get rid of him. And
a couple weeks later,
I get a check from him for $500 written on the Auburn Correctional Facility commissary account.
That's great.
I mean, imagine my embarrassment. You know, I was like, oh, my God, I can't believe this poor guy is sending me money. You know,
so the million-dollar question, Lonnie, is did you cash it?
You know, embarrassingly, I did.
And it was the best $500 I ever spent.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Good for you.
In fact, and that was how I actually got with Jonathan Ellison as well. I sent him a check for $1,500. He sent it back, though. He said that,
he's a better man than I am.
He sent it back and said that this was the most disturbing case that he ever seen.
Wow.
And that I had the 440 in already, the motion to vacate judgment in, that he couldn't take my money because the work was done. But he would file a friend of the court brief, you know, explaining that I should get a hearing in the court on my actual innocence evidence. And once the judge didn't do the right thing, he took on the appeal pro bono. And that's how the landmark decision came down this year in the appellate division that ruled for the first time in New York history that a freestanding, actual innocent claim can be heard by a lower court. And it was an amazing decision because judges usually would bar guys say, you know, there's a procedural bar, you can't get in because of this reason or that reason, and wouldn't hear the merits of the claim. And since Mr. Ellerstein had it struck down, okay, you know, it changes things for a lot of people that's innocent. They'd be able to have a judge actually hear their case. So it was a remarkable decision in moving our case forward as well.
I can't imagine how elated you were when you heard that news.
Oh, it was a long time coming. You know, it was very, very, it was on my anniversary that it came down as well. So, and it was a very good day for me and my wife. We really enjoyed that.
Now, this next question I'm going to pose to both you gentlemen, Lonnie and Derek. Lonnie, you first. Do you think, since you've dealt with many, many people wrongfully committed, and I'm sure you know some people who are properly committed, rightfully, time behind jails, do you think rehabilitation is possible in jail?
not institutionally. I think there are individuals that somehow manage to survive and get through. But everybody, you know, I mean, a perfect example is education. Pataki, when he was governor, removed state-supported educational programs in prisons. I mean, I can't believe, it's almost unbelievable. And for years, the only education available were, you know, like volunteer programs from maybe local colleges or churches, this and that. And that exists now. Cuomo, just this last budget, put only $1 million allocation out of the $428 million, I think it's maybe more than that, corrections budget. $1 million he put in, and then he withdrew it before the budget negotiations.
Wow.
He withdrew it because people, you know, there were other state elected officials who complained. He couldn't even get $1 million into the budget. I can't even say the word. So
unfathomable. It seems like that wouldn't even cover computers for all the jails.
Shocking that they would take that money out and not have education in prison and how difficult it is. So no, there's very little, if any, rehabilitation. I wouldn't say Derek knows better. There are some good people that work in the prison system and counselors and this and that. But it's an abomination.
Derek, your viewpoint?
Well, from my point, Lonnie is right. Institutional is not going to happen. Usually what happens is some prisoner gets educated, and then he gets a classroom, and whoever want to volunteer and share in the education that he received can come. So you have to want to go where the knowledge is. And that's just what happens. If you want to walk around the yard with a guy that tells you war stories, then you will. If you want to walk to around a guy, you know, a guy that's a mentor that can help you get you, you know, your mind on somewhere else, it will. So you have to want it, and you have to want to separate yourself from the norm. I mean, the norm in prison is basketball, sports, you know, weightlifting, you know, and just wasting time. That's the norm in prison. The programs
staying
they got
alive
to,
too.
If
I
you
imagine.
You look at the rule book. If you look at the inmate misbehavior rule book. Some of the rules that they have say that I can't give you a sandwich if you're hungry and you're living right next door, maybe in my cell with me. That's a violation of the rule. So they teach antisocial behavior, you know, and then they expect a person to be normal on his own. You have to want it. You have to really. One of the things I always did when I was in prison, when the prison guard gave me something, I would say thank you. And some of the guys would be, how can you thank him, man? He's your enemy. Because I want to keep my manners. I want to keep what I came here with. I don't want to lose my soul in prison for the sakes of, you know, what I'm going through. So you have to be grounded, and you have to know. You know, you have to remember what you raised, how you was raised. You know, don't lose it in prison, because it's easy. When you get to prison, what you're going to experience is, you know, some guy giving you antisocial values. He's going to say, hey, if a guy step on your toe, you punch him in the mouth. You know, you let these guys know. You know, it's a whole different mentality.
Sure.
And if you feed into that, then you may be there the rest of your life. You know, you have to humble yourself. You have to say, hey, trouble's over there. I'm going to go the other way. Forget about how somebody may perceive me or think about me. You know, I'm going to do the right thing.
Well, that's a question I wanted to broach, Derek. Was there a part of you that had to become falsely invented to survive?
Well, you know, one of the things I always say is about you. You don't have to, I mean, you don't have to feed into the hype. I mean, that's what people do. They get caught up into the hype. If you mind your business most of the time and you do the things that people that mind their business do, you won't get in any trouble. You know, but if you run around and you put your chest out, you know, somebody's going to challenge you, whether it's a prison guard or inmate. You know, somebody want to see if you're really that tough guy. You know, there's always somebody tougher than you. You know, my advice to anybody that may find yourself in that situation is to get a book, you know, stay in your cell as much as possible, and just stay out the way.
What about the, obviously, the plethora of drugs and other illicit opportunities within the confines of jail? Did that give you some release, some sort of vacation, or allow you to transport yourself away from jail, or did you not partake at all?
But the problem with that is when you open your eyes after the high is gone, you're still here.
Yeah, absolutely. Temporary.
Get around them bars when you're locked in there. You're going to see those no matter how high you get, you know?
How much counseling did you take part of?
Counseling was, you know, like I said, it was self-help groups. You know, the funny thing about, well, not the funny thing, the sad thing, I should say, about prison with me, whenever I ask them for mental health, they refuse me. They would say, there's nothing wrong with you. And I would say, you can't tell me there's nothing wrong with me. You know, I'm sitting here in the medicine. And actually, I filed a lawsuit and lost. Yeah, I lost.
On what grounds?
I lost for health, and I mean mental health. They never gave it to me.
What were the grounds? What was the ruling?
Well, the lawsuit said that, you know, I'm not a doctor. And even though they didn't give it to me, I can't show that I actually had these mental health, you know, issues.
Because you weren't seen by a physician.
Right. That was my argument, that, you know, I had a perfunctory review. You know, you get some social worker that says, oh, you okay, never get me to a psychiatrist. You know, it's money. It's a money. It's really a money thing. You know, everything is about a dollar.
What about a job in jail? Did you have employment?
Yeah, you know, you're always going to get employment. You get paid maybe, you know, 5 cents an hour or something like that, 45 cents a day. But you
hey, with that rate, you can afford a good person like Lonnie.
Oh, boy, I'm going to have to live with this.
Well, I got to go because I've been holding up a line for a minute at work. I'm actually at work.
As a paralegal at a prestigious law firm in Midtown, and that must make you feel like you're pretty invincible right now.
Well, Edelstein and Grossman is the firm at 501 Fifth Avenue in New York, New York. I'm working for, you know...
Are you inviting us over for lunch, Derek?
Yes. Okay. Robert Grossman, the two guys that I admire. I think that they're the best, you know, the legal minds in New York when it comes to post-conviction and appeals. So my work here is very much appreciated. I'm happy to be here.
And certainly they believe in you.
Uh-huh.
All the best to you, Derek, and the future. I mean, obviously it's got to be bright. Just do me a favor, one more second. What did you feel when you opened that prison door and you were released and you took that first fresh air breath of freedom? How did you feel?
Oh, man.
Scared and elated?
Let me tell you a story. I was in Auburn Correctional Facility, and they have a church right across the street. And I took a ritual of every time the church bells would go on, I would pray. I would say the Our Father, the Hail Mary, and the St. Michael prayer. So the first day that I walked out of prison, my nephew, my wife, and my son was there, and I had to find that church. You know, I went to the church, and I went in there, and I prayed. And it was the most joyous feeling in the world, you know, to be able to actually walk in this church door, and I heard the bell so much. And then we went on down to Albany with my son and had a nice meal, and I went on home. It was the best. It was like a rebirth for me. It was like a dream come true.
It sounds like a great ending and also a brilliant new beginning for you.
Thank you very much.
Derek Hamilton, all the best to you, my friend.
All right.
Lonnie, so you must be very happy, certainly, with all the work you've done. You have a lot more work ahead of you, I guess.
Well, it's very difficult. I get letters every day from inmates with stories that are just too unbelievable and too sad, and there's so few people working on these things, and, you know, I just take a couple of cases and... But, you know, we really need to get the law firms involved, the big law firms. You know, there are thousands of lawyers. They talk about pro bono commitment. But I find that, you know, they're so selective about the cases they take. In fact, when I got Derek's case, the first thing I did was contact a big law firm in New York that I had been doing some work with. And I asked them, do you take pro bono cases? And they said yes. And they looked at Derek's case. In fact, they even sent an investigator up to Connecticut to interview the police woman, the police official who was with Derek at the time 20 years earlier, who was his alibi witness, and they believed he had good evidence, but they rejected his case. And
too many unbilled hours, probably, they predicted.
I think it may have been because he had a prior.
Oh, I see.
That's my guess.
What was his prior?
He was involved in some kind of manslaughter. He was a kid. I think he was a lookout. Some kid said, hey, you know, would you look out? And the next thing you know, he was arrested. But I think he was able to actually overturn his conviction even then, that first conviction. So he had he was a street kid. Like, listen, you know, most of these guys, you know, that you meet from, you know, the poor kids from Bed-Stuy had some prior. You know, these kids, you know, wrongfully convicted, you know, there's some involvement with the system. That's how, I mean, I tell my kids, if you get a parking ticket, don't go into the precinct to pay it, you know, because if something happened in the neighborhood, they're going to question you. So, you know, the people in prison are generally poor and minority. And in those communities, I mean, look at Stop and Frisk. I mean, that gave hundreds of thousands of poor black kids records, black and Hispanic kids. So, they have to step up. The law firms need to step up. I mean, they need representation, and that's the thing I find most heartbreaking, and especially post-conviction. You know, that the legal aid doesn't really have the resources post-conviction to take these cases. Marty Tankleff had five different major law firms working on his case.
Five? Wow.
Five. And all pro bono. Damien Echols, you know, raised a lot of money for the West Memphis Three. Laurie Davis, his wife, raised a lot of money. Millions and millions of dollars to pay lawyers over the years. And it's very hard. There's so
it's very disheartening, the fact that I mean, people are doing this almost pro bono, but it still costs millions of dollars, obviously, to get the wheels turning.
Well, you know, I mean, if you looked at Derek's file, just making copies of the file would be, you know, $10,000. And all these cases, you know, there are 50 Scarsella-related cases that that's the ones the DA is recognizing. Scarsella claims that he was involved in approximately 300 murder cases or homicide cases. So there are God knows how many more, and those are just, you know, the tip of the iceberg.
And we failed to mention that this is a highly decorated former detective. And we touched on this earlier, Lonnie, about how we can fix this. We talked about the double blind aspect and videotaping. Are there any other concepts that you think that should be implemented to kind of fix the broken system here?
Well, like I said, I think you need to have conviction review units similar to the one that was started in Dallas, Texas, by Craig Watkins, the DA. In that model, the attorneys, defense attorneys, prosecutors, and defendants are all part of the same meetings, or the same information is shared when they're reviewing cases. They're transparent, and that resulted in 44 wrongful convictions being overturned. I was involved and currently involved with a case called, based on the film Capturing the Freedmans, involving Jesse Friedman, who was sentenced to, who served 13 and a half years on a mass sexual abuse hysteria case. And Jesse is innocent. He came out about 10 years ago and has been trying to overturn his conviction because he's a level 3 sex offender. Finally, the courts rejected, actually what's called the Second Circuit, which is the court right below the Supreme Court, said that he was too late in filing his papers, but their exact quote from their decision was that there was a likelihood that he was wrongfully convicted. And they asked the DA in Nassau County, Kathleen Rice, to review his case. And she took 3 years in a completely non-transparent way. Ron Kuby was the attorney, and Andrew Jarecki, the filmmaker, got most of the evidence and supported the case. And it took 3 years, and she rejected it some months ago. And it was just horrible to go through that process where we had no collaboration with the DA. There was evidence, a number of the children who were allegedly sexually assaulted recanted. We had evidence from families that came out. We had tremendous evidence of Jesse's innocence. But they fought as if their life depended on it. And I gotta tell you a funny story. When Damien Echols in the West Memphis 3 case, he and I were speaking in front of at a law firm just a few months after he was released. And one of the young lawyers asked how he was wrongfully convicted. And I was prepared to give this long answer, and I thought he would give some long answer. And Damien looked at him, and he said, "I have one word, ambition."
Great.
And it was like, oh, my God. It cut through. And he said, you know, the police investigators became police chiefs. The police chiefs became prosecutors. The prosecutors became judges.
And so on and so on.
And the judges became senator. All on the back of my death penalty conviction.
Lonnie, we're almost out of time.
Great.
But quickly, Derek is no longer on the phone, and I would have asked this of Derek, but what kind of life does Derek Hamilton have in front of him beyond the exoneration, et cetera? How much struggle do you think he's going to experience?
It is a huge struggle. First of all, anybody that serves that amount of time, whether it's Jesse Friedman, Damien Echols, Richard DiGuglielmo, who I'm representing, who was a police officer, suffers post-traumatic stress syndrome. Marty Tankleff, you know, however well they do, it's a struggle. And guys like Marty, who's about to graduate law school, or Derek, who's just so directed, just think about all the other guys out there, and many of the wrongfully convicted who get out by parole, finally. Mm-hmm. But so they're still wrongfully convicted. They're on parole for years. They can't get jobs.
The stigma still exists.
Excuse me?
The stigma still exists for a lifetime.
Oh, yes. And, I mean, there's active laws preventing them from, you know, look at Derek. Here, he gets a call from the parole officer saying, I need your DNA. He's been out for 3 years.
And he has to leave his job at a law firm as a paralegal to go to Connecticut to give DNA.
Hey, and New York has his DNA, so there's no compassion in this.
There's no reciprocity, obviously, either.
Well, I mean, there is, but, you know, they don't want to hassle. They don't want to have to make a call or file a paper or... So,
no, why do that?
Yeah, right. So it's a struggle for these people. That's why we need to get these convictions overturned. We need law firms to step up and take some of these cases that aren't popular, that are people of color, you know, that come from Bed-Stuy or St. Louis or the communities where wrongful convictions, where most of the convictions happen. And that's what will begin to change the system, and we have to hold prosecutors accountable.
And persons like yourself, Lonnie Suri, you know, actively doing what you do, and I greatly appreciate it. Not comparably much as Derek Hamilton will and has will for life, that's for sure.
He's a leader.
Thank you for your time, Lonnie, and all the continued success of leading falseconfessions.org.
This was great, and thank you so much for giving us a voice.
Our pleasure. Wow, that's a lot. That's pretty heavy.
It's a lot to take in.
Makes you not want to break the law. Those stats were something else. Wrongfully imprisoned people, far from exonerated. I mean, the numbers are kind of frightening, that's for sure. But good for Derek for, you know, righting the wrong, for his steadfast work for 21 years, for doing all that research. I applaud and take my hat off to him and hope this broken system gets fixed very quickly. Always big thank you to all the PRN folks around here, Jason, Casey, and Giselle at the controls. Mattiani, where are you? I guess he's on the street panhandling again. Liz, did you have fun today?
It was an interesting show.
It was. Scared straight, I am. My name is Mark Farrell with Liz Malone. We'll catch you next Thursday on PRN.FM for another episode and segment of Insight. Have a great weekend. Happy Easter and happy Passover. Enjoy.